über Why the Church is as True as the Gospel und über Eugene England. Jahrelang in die Kirche gehen und Sonntag für Sonntag meckern und sich freuen, wenn man wieder zu Hause ist. Mein Pi sagt die Schwester und den kleinen Bruder und vielleicht ist man eine Qual für die Eltern in der Abendmahlsversammlung. Und eines Tages trifft einen der Heilige Geist und alles ist anders. Irgendetwas hat die wertvolle und einzigartige Perle vom Klumpen Lehm, der sie umgab, befreit. Und man sieht sie in all ihrer unverwechselbaren Herrlichkeit, Wert und Schönheit. So ging es Eugene England im Alter von 12 Jahren auf einer Pfahlkonferenz. Ich hatte so etwas auch einmal im Juni 2002 bei einer Satellitenübertragung zur Neuweihung des wiedererbauten Nauvoo-Tempels. Eigentlich war ich zu diesem Zeitpunkt schon fast mit beiden Beinen voll in Ablehnung der Kirche. Das Lied »Der Geist aus den Höhen« mochte ich auch nie wirklich. Aber da traf es mich. Vielleicht war es auch immer so eine Art Anker für meinen Glauben, der in den Jahren 2003 bis 2011 eine ganz andere Richtung nehmen sollte. Sicher war das Erlebnis, dass Eugene England bei seiner Begegnung mit Harold B. Lee, der einige Jahre später Präsident der Kirche Jesu Christi der Heiligen der letzten Tage sein sollte, hatte, ein ganz ähnlicher Anker in seinem Glauben. Ein Erlebnis, das sein ganzes Verständnis dessen, was die Kirche für ihn war, verändert hatte. Vielleicht sollte es auch eine Basis für noch viele weitere Erlebnisse im Glauben sein, die ihm letztlich die Kraft gaben, auch dann sein Glauben nicht zu verlieren, wenn dieser durch einen Bruce Amerconkey und andere Personen des Kollegiums der 12 Apostel frustriert wurde. Sein Aufsatz »Why the Church is as True as the Gospel« ist gerade im Lichte dieser Frustration bewegend. England schafft es, die Kirche und seinen Glauben in einem völlig neuen Licht zu sehen. Dort, wo das Mitglied zwischen den beiden klassischen Polen, die Kirche ist vollkommen, aber die Mitglieder sind es nicht, und der Feststellung des ehemaligen aktiven Mitglieds, dass die Kirche vielleicht oder vielleicht nicht einige wahre Aussagen trifft, diese aber nicht mehr für mich zutreffen, kein Mittelmaß kennt. Dort schafft Eugene England es, in dem Lehmklumpen des Unvollkommenen, schrägen, merkwürdigen, menschlichen und des manchmal auch verkorksten an der Institution Kirche Jesu Christi der Heiligen der letzten Tage die wertvolle und einzigartige Perle des Göttlichen zu finden. Weil die Kirche es schafft, eine Struktur zu sein, die in ihrer Menschlichkeit und Unvollkommenheit doch mit dem Göttlichen und Vollkommenen verbunden zu bleiben scheint. England schreibt, ich bin aufgrund meiner eigenen Erfahrungen, sowie meine Erfahrung damals auf der Pfahlkonferenz, davon überzeugt, dass die Kirche in der Tat so wahr, so effektiv und so sicher ein Instrument der Errettung ist, wie das System von Lehren und Grundsätzen, die wir das Evangelium nennen. Und sie ist es zum größten Teil gerade aufgrund gerade dieser Fehler, der menschlichen Verzweiflung und der historischen Probleme, die uns manchmal an der Kirche so viel Kummer machen. Für England ist es die Synergie der Gegensätze, die Leben und Nützliches schaffen. Gut und Böse, konservativ und liberal, Mann und Frau, Gerechtigkeit und Gnade, Freiheit und Ordnung, Romantik und Klassizismus, Integrität und gesellschaftliche Verantwortung. Und eben auch Menschlichkeit und Göttlichkeit in der Kirche. Das Leben sei voller Gegensätze und wird durch sie bereichert. Und so hebt England die Diskussionen von den einfachen und vielleicht auch langweiligen Wahrheiten, ich weiß, die Kirche ist wahr, auf eine andere, mehrdimensionalere Ebene. Auf der Wahrheit durch unvollkommene Menschen in einer unvollkommenen Institution fühlbar und erlebbar wird. Für ihn ist die Institution Kirche so vollkommen wie die Institution Ehe. Beide halten große Verheißungen. Und beide sind eine Plattform für große Verzweiflung, viel Selbstaufgabe, Dienst und aller Art Menschlichkeit und Merkwürdigkeit, um die Verheißung zu erreichen, welche letztlich doch ein Gottesgeschenk bleibt. Über Eugene England. Eugene England wurde am 22. Juli 1933 in Logan in Utah geboren. Er wuchs in Idaho auf, wo sein Vater eine Getreidefarm besaß. Sein Zeugnis von Gottes Wirken in der Kirche Jesu Christi der Heiligen der letzten Tage erhielt er im Alter von 12 Jahren auf einer Konferenz seines Pfarrers, als der damals noch als Apostel amtierende Harold B. Lee das Konferenzgebäude betrat und der junge Eugene auf übernatürliche Weise spürte, dass der Besucher ein in besonderem Maße bevollmächtigter Diener Gottes war. Im Alter von 20 Jahren heiratete er Charlotte Hawkins, mit der er bald nach der Hochzeit eine HLT-Mission nach Samoa antrat. Nach einer Zeit als Captain in der US-Luftwaffe besuchte Eugene England die Universität von Stanford, wo er sowohl von der Studentenbewegung der 60er Jahre als auch von seiner HLT-Studentengemeinde, in der er aktiv war und eine leitende Berufung innehatte, beeinflusst wurde. Während seiner Zeit in Stanford traf England Wesley Johnson, mit dem zusammen er das akademische Magazin über mormonische Kultur Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, entwickelte und herausgab. Nachdem England Stanford verließ, unterrichtete er am St. Olaf Lutheran College in Minnesota, während er seine Dissertation schrieb, die er 1974 beendete. Als jedoch einige Studenten begannen, ihr Interesse am Mormonismus zu bekunden und deren Eltern formell Beschwerde vorbrachten, wurde England jedoch gezwungen, die Universität zu verlassen. Daraufhin wurde er an der Universität von Utah vorstellig und erhielt eine Dozentenstelle an der Fakultät für Religionswissenschaften, an der er 2 Jahre unterrichtete, bevor er eine Professur an der Brigham Young Universität, der BYU, erhielt. An der BYU konnte England zusätzlich Vorlesungen in mormonischer Literatur geben und war im Jahre 1976 an der Gründung der Association for Mormon Letters beteiligt, welche das Ziel hatte, die Würdigung mormonischer Literatur zu erhöhen. Auch untersuchte er religiöse Themen in wichtigen literarischen Standardwerken. Während seiner ersten Jahre an der Brigham Young Universität war England in seiner fruchtbarsten Schaffensphase. Er schrieb Bücher mit bekannt gewordenen Aufsätzen wie Dialogue with Myself und Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, Poesie, eine Biografie und zahlreiche Artikel. Im Jahre 1981 erhielt England einen Brief vom damaligen HLT-Apostel Bruce R. McConkie, welchen er las, als dieser bereits an die Presse durchgesichert war. In diesem Brief kritisierte McConkie England scharf für seine Auffassung, dass Gottes eigener, ewiger Fortschritt darin bestehe, dass Gott neue Wahrheiten erlernen könne. Die Historikerin Claudia Bushman schrieb später zu diesem Thema: Die Auseinandersetzung zwischen McConkie und England offenbarte die Trennung zwischen theologischen Konservativen und Liberalen unter den Gläubigen und im weiteren Sinne den Konflikt zwischen autoritärer Kontrolle und Meinungsfreiheit. In seinem letzten Lebensjahrzehnt fühlte sich England zunehmend für seine Arbeit unter Druck gesetzt, was ihn dazu trieb, im Jahre 1998 von der BYU zu emeritieren. Ihm wurde daraufhin eine Arbeit als Gastprofessor am Utah Valley State College in Orem in Utah angeboten. Dort gründete er das Center for the Study of Mormon Culture als Teil der Fakultät für Religionswissenschaften der Universität. Bevor England das Zentrum für mormonische Kultur vollständig etablieren konnte, erkrankte er an einem lähmenden Gehirntumor. Trotz einer Operation, die 2 Zysten und einen Teil des Tumors entfernte, starb Eugene England am 17. August 2001. Eugene England beschrieb das Ideal des mormonischen Wissenschaftlers als so kritisch und innovativ, wie seine Gaben von Gott dies erfordern, sich jedoch seiner einzigartigen Herkunft und Gemeinschaft bewusst und ihnen gegenüber loyal zu sein, um diese Gaben dadurch ohne Schaden für sich und andere auszuüben. Why the Church is as True as the Gospel by Eugene England. I was convinced when I was a boy that the most boring meeting in the church, perhaps in the world, was a quarterly stake conference. In those days, stake conference was indeed held every 3 months. It included at least 2 2-hour sessions on Sunday for everyone. And the most interesting highlights to us children were the quavery songs literally rendered by the Singing Mothers chorus and the sober sustaining of the Stake No Liquor Tobacco Committee. But one conference when I was 12 was memorable for a better reason. I was sitting near the front because my father was being sustained as a high counselor in a newly formed stake, and I was turned around in my seat, teasing my sister who was sitting behind me. Suddenly I felt something vaguely familiar, burning the center of my heart and bones, and then it seemed physically turning me around to look at the transfigured face of Elder Harold B. Lee, the visiting authority. He had interrupted his prepared sermon and was giving a new stake, an apostolic blessing. And I became aware, for the second and confirming time in my life, of the presence of the Holy Ghost and the special witness of Jesus Christ. How many boring stake conferences would I attend to even be once in the presence of such grace? Thousands. All there are. That pearl is without price. And because I have since learned better what to look for and find there, understanding of an edifying, inspirational experience with the members of the church, the conferences are no longer boring. Thus, one of the earliest and most important pillars of my faith came, not through some great insight into the gospel, but through an experience I could have had only because I was doing my duty in the church, however immaturely. Yet, one of the clichés often repeated by Mormons is that the gospel is true, even perfect, But the church is, after all, a human instrument, history-bound, and therefore understandably imperfect, as if it were something to be endured for the sake of the gospel. I am persuaded, by experiences like that one, at a stake conference, and by my best thinking, that in fact the church is as true, as effective, as sure an instrument of salvation as the system of doctrines we call the gospel. And that it is so in good part because of the very flaws, human exasperations, and historical problems that occasionally give us all some anguish about the church. Those who use the cliché about the gospel being more true than the church want to mean by the gospel a perfect system of revealed doctrines and commandments based in principle and with which infallibly express the natural laws of the universe. Interestingly enough, the universe itself, and thus the true laws and principles of the gospel uses to describe the universe, appear to be fundamentally paradoxical. Lehi's law. It must needs be that there is an opposition in all things, as in 2 Nephi 2:11, is perhaps the most provocative and profound statement of abstract theology in the scriptures, because it describes what apparently is the most ultimate in the universe. In context, it clearly suggests that not only is contradiction and opposition a natural part of human experience, something God uses for his redemptive purposes, but that opposition is at the very heart of things. It is intrinsic to the two most fundamental realities, intelligence and matter, what Lehi calls things to act and things to be acted upon, as in verse 14. According to Lehi, opposition provides the universe with energy and meaning, even makes possible the existence of God and everything else. Without it, all things must have vanished away. We all know in our experience the consequence of for mortal life of this fundamental eternal reality. Throughout history, the most important and productive ideas have been paradoxical, that is, in useful opposition to each other. The energizing force in all art has been conflict and opposition. The basis for success in all economic, political, and other social development has been competition and dialogue. Think of our government based on checks and balances and our two-party political system, which together make a pluralistic democracy possible. Think of Romanticism versus Classicism, a conflict at the heart of much literature and most literary movements, reason versus emotion, freedom versus order, individual integrity versus community responsibility, men versus women, whose differences make eternal increase possible, justice versus mercy, whose combination makes our redemption through the atonement of Christ possible. Life in this universe is full of polarities and is made full by them. We struggle with them, complain about them, even try sometimes to destroy them with dogmatism or self-righteousness, or a retreat into the innocence that is only ignorance, a return to the Garden of Eden where there is deceptive ease and clarity, but no salvation. William Blake, the great 18th century poet, taught that without contraries there is no existence, and warned that whoever tries to reconcile the contraries seeks to destroy existence, whatever it means that we will eventually see face to face. Now we can see only through a glass, darkly, like in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12, and we had better make the best of it. Certainly, if we mean by the gospel simply the good news of Christ's redemption, as it is used often in the New Testament, or if we mean simply the basic principles of salvation implied when we say, I know the gospel is true, we are talking about something fairly definite and clear. But as we know in human terms, the full gospel is not, and perhaps given the apparently paradoxical nature of the universe itself, cannot ever be a simple and clear set of unequivocal propositions. However clear and unified our ultimate knowledge of doctrine will be, our present understanding of the gospel, which is what we actually have to deal with, is various and limited. And that is precisely where the church comes in. I believe the church is the best medium, apart from marriage, which it much resembles in this respect, for helping us gain salvation by grappling constructively with the oppositions of existence. Despite our limited and various understandings of the gospel. I believe that the better any church or organization is at such help, the truer it is. And when I call the Mormon Church the true church, I mean that it is the best organized means for providing such help, because it is divinely organized and directed, is made and kept effective by revelations that have come and continue to come from God, however darkly they, of necessity, come to our own limited and various understandings. Martin Luther, with inspired perception, wrote, "Marriage is the school of love," that is, marriage is not the home or the result of love so much as the school. I believe that any church can be a school of love, and that the Mormon Church is the best one, the only true and living church, as the Doctrine and Covenants 1 verse 30. Not just because its doctrines teach and embody the great essential paradoxes and central saving principles, but also because the church provides the best context for struggling with, working through, enduring, and being redeemed by our responses to those paradoxes and oppositions that give energy and meaning to the universe. Joseph Smith, also with inspired perception, wrote in a letter just before his death, "By proving contraries, truth is made manifest." By prove, he meant not only to demonstrate logically, but also to test, to struggle with, and to work out in practical experience. The church is as true, as effective, as the gospel because it involves us directly in proving contraries, working constructively with the oppositions within ourselves and especially between people, struggling at an experiential level with paradoxes and polarities that can help to redeem us. The church is as true because it is concrete, not theoretical. And despite, even because of, its contradictions and problems, it is as productive of good as is the gospel. Let us consider why this is so. In the life of the true church, as in a good marriage, there are constant opportunities for all to serve, especially to learn to serve people we would not normally choose to serve or possibly even associate with. And thus there are opportunities to learn to love unconditionally, which, after all, is the most important thing to learn in the gospel. There is constant encouragement, even pressure, to be active, to have a calling, and thus to have to grapple with relationships and management, with other people's ideas and wishes, their feelings and failures, to attend classes and meetings and to have to listen to other people's sometimes misinformed and prejudiced notions and to have to make some constructive response, to be subject to leaders and occasionally to be hurt by their weakness and blindness, even unrighteous dominion, and then to be called to a leadership position and find that we, too, with all best intentions, can be weak and blind and unrighteous. Church involvement teaches us compassion and patience, as well as courage and discipline. It makes us responsible for the personal and marital, the physical and spiritual welfare of people we may not already love, may even heartily dislike, and thus we learn to love them. It stretches and challenges us, even when we are disappointed and exasperated, in ways we would not otherwise choose to be stretched and challenged. Thus it gives us a chance to be made better than we may have chosen to be, but need and ultimately want to be. Michael Novak, the lay Catholic theologian, has made the same point concerning marriage. In a remarkable essay published in the April 1976 Harper's Magazine, he reviewed an increasing inclination of modern intellectuals to resist, desert, and even to attack marriage, and argued that the main reason why the family, which has traditionally been the main bulwark of economic and emotional security, is currently out of favor, is that many modern opinion makers are unwilling to take the risks and subject themselves to the disciplines that the school of marriage requires. But he then pointed out how such fears, though justified, keep them from meeting their own greatest needs. Similarly, I believe that those who resist, desert, and attack the church fail from a simple lack of perspective to see their own best interest. To better see what I mean, as you read this passage from Novak, mentally substitute the church for marriage. Marriage is an assault upon the lonely atomic ego. Marriage is a threat to the solitary individual. Marriage does impose grueling, humbling, baffling, and frustrating responsibilities. Yet if none supposes that precisely such things are the preconditions for all true liberation, marriage is not the enemy of moral development in adults. Quite the opposite. Being married and having children has impressed on my mind certain lessons. For those learning, I cannot help being grateful. Most are lessons of difficulty and duress. Most of what I am forced to learn about myself is not pleasant. My dignity as a human being depends perhaps more on what sort of husband and parent I am than on any professional work I am called upon to do. My bonds to my family hold me back, and my wife even more, from many sorts of opportunities. And yet these do not feel like bonds. They are, I know, my liberation. They force me to be a different sort of human being in a way in which I want and need to be forced. I bear witness that the church can do those same frustrating, humbling, but ultimately liberating and redeeming things for us. If we can learn to see it as Novak does marriage, if we can see that it's assaults on our lonely egos, its bonds and responsibilities, which we accept willingly, can push us toward new kinds of being in a way we most deeply want and need to be pushed. Two keys to this paradoxical power in the Mormon Church are, first, that it is, by revelation, a lay church, radically so more than any other, and second, that it organizes its congregations geographically rather than by personal choice. I know that there are exceptions, but the basic church experience of almost all Mormons brings them directly and constantly into very demanding and intimate relationships with a range of people and problems in their assigned congregations that are not primarily of their own choosing, but are profoundly redemptive in potential, in part because they are not consciously chosen. Yes, the ordinances performed through the church are important, as are its scriptural texts and moral exhortations and spiritual conduits. But even these, in my experience, are powerful and redemptive partly because they work harmoniously with profound, life-giving oppositions through the church structure to give truth and meaning to the religious life of Mormons. Let me illustrate. In one of his last general conference messages during the Saturday evening priesthood session of October 5, 1968, President David O. McKay gave a kind of final testament that was a bit shocking to many of us who are conditioned to expect that prophets have no difficulty in getting divine manifestations. He told how he struggled in vain all through his teenage years to get God to declare to me the truth of his revelation to Joseph Smith. He prayed fervently and sincerely, in the hills and at home, but he had to admit to himself constantly, no spiritual manifestation has come to me. But he continued to seek truth and to serve others in the context of Mormonism, including going on a mission to Britain, mainly because of trust in his parents and the goodness of his own experience. Finally, as President McKay put it, the spiritual manifestation for which I had prayed as a boy in my teens came as a natural sequence to their performance of duty. For, as the Apostle John declared, if any man will do his will, he shall know the doctrine, whether it be of God, or whether I speak of myself, as in John 7:17. Following a series of meetings at the conference held in Glasgow, Scotland, was a most remarkable priesthood meeting. I remember as if it were yesterday the intensity of the inspiration of that occasion. Everybody felt the rich outpouring of the Spirit of the Lord. All present were truly of one heart and of one mind. Never before had I experienced such an emotion. It was a manifestation for which, as a doubting youth, I had secretly prayed most earnestly on hillside and in meadow. During the process of the meeting, an elder on his own initiative arose and said, "Brethren, there are angels in this room." Strange as it may seem, the announcement was not startling. Indeed, it seemed wholly proper, though it had not occurred to me that there were divine beings present. I only knew that I was overflowing with gratitude for the presence of the Holy Spirit. I have had many confirmations of President McKay's prophetic witness in that sermon. Most of my profound spiritual manifestations, those that have provided the rock bottom and convictions I have about the reality of God and Christ and their divine work, as well as my most troubling, soul-stretching moral challenges, my most maturing struggles with the great human issues of personal integrity versus public responsibility, loyalty to self versus loyalty to community, redemptive freedom versus redemptive structure and order, all these have come, as President McKay affirmed, as a natural sequence to the performance of duty in the church. I know that God has been found by unusual people in unusual places. In a sudden vision in a grove, or orchard, or grotto, or on a mountain, or in a closet, or through saintly service to African lepers or Calcutta untouchables. But I am convinced that for most of us, and most of the time, he can be found most surely in natural sequence to the performance of the duties he has given us that all of us, not just the unusual, can perform in our own homes and neighborhoods. And that the church, in its unique community, imposed as well as chosen, can best teach and empower us to perform. I have come to an overwhelming witness of the divinity of the Book of Mormon, such that the Spirit moves me even to tears whenever I read any part of it. And I came there by teaching in a church. One Sunday, when I was a bishop, as I tried to help a young woman who had attempted suicide a number of times, once not long before that, and who was feeling the deepest worthlessness and self-rejection, I was moved to merely read to her some passages from the Book of Mormon about Christ's atonement. I am convinced that the book provides the most comprehensive Christology, or doctrine of how Christ saves us from sin, that is available to us on earth, and that the internal evidences for the divinity of the book entirely overwhelm the evidences and arguments against it. But more important to me than all of those things is that as I read those passages to that desperate young woman and bore witness of their truth and power in my own times of despair and sin, her lips began to tremble with new feelings, and tears of hope formed in the place of those of anguish. In moments such as these, I was able, through my calling as a bishop, to apply the atoning blood of Christ, not in theory, but in truth of experience. In addition, I have come to know the ministering of angels because I have done my duty in temple attendance and have gone whenever possible to temple dedications. And I have found that we mortals do indeed have the power to bless our oxen, as well as people, because I was branch president and was pushed to the limits of my faith by my sense of responsibility to my brothers and sisters in that little branch. Before I was a branch president, I served in the bishopric of the Stanford ward in the mid-16s and taught religion at the Palo Alto Institute to bright young students. At the same time, I was doing graduate work in English literature and trying to come to terms with modern skepticism and relativism and the moral dilemmas of the civil rights and anti-war movements and the educational revolutions of the time. I tended to see religion very much in terms of large moral and philosophical issues. In 1970, I accepted a position as Dean of Academic Affairs at St. Olaf, a Lutheran liberal arts college in the small town of Northfield, Minnesota, and within a week of arriving was called as president of the Little Latter-day Saint branch in that area. I suddenly entered an entirely different world, one that tested me severely and taught me much about what religion is. At Stanford, much of my religious life had been involved with understanding and defending the gospel, and had been idealistic, abstract, and critical. In Northfield, as branch president for 20 families scattered over 75 miles, ranging from Utah-born hardcore inactives with devastating marital problems to bright-eyed converts with no jobs or with drunken fathers who beat them, I soon became involved in a religious life that was practical, specific, sacrificial, exasperating, and more satisfying and redemptive. And I saw more clearly than before how the church is an instrument for confronting all kinds of people with the processes of salvation, despite, even because of, its management by imperfect instruments like myself. I think of a young man in that branch who had been deeply injured socially by some combination of mental and family problems. It was difficult for him even to speak a word in a group or to organize his life productively. He joined the church before I arrived, and as we gave him increasing responsibilities in our branch and supported him with much love and patience while he struggled to work with others and express himself, I was able to see him grow into a fine leader and confident husband and father. I think of a woman whose non-member husband made her life a hell of drunken abuse, but who patiently took care of him, worked all week to support her family, and came to church each Sunday in drab but jaunty finery and with uncomplaining determination. She found there, with our help, little hope, some beauty and idealism, and strength not only to endure, but to go on loving what was unlovable. The church blessed us all by bringing us together. During the 5 years I served them, there were, among those 70 to 100 members, perhaps 4 or 5 whom I would have normally chosen for friends when I was at Stanford, and with whom I could have easily shared my most impassioned and important political and religious concerns and views, the ones that had so exercised me before. But with inspiration far beyond my usual less than good sense, I did not begin my tenure as branch president by preaching about my ideas or promoting my crusades. I tried very hard to see what the immediate problems and concerns of my flock were, and to be a good pastor, one who fed and protected them. And a remarkable thing happened. I traveled hundreds of miles and spent many hours helping a couple who had hurt each other into absolute silence learn to talk to each other again, seeing a student through drug withdrawal, teaching a somewhat domineering man to work cooperatively with his counselors in the Sunday school presidency, blessing a terribly sick baby aided by its father, who was weak in faith and frightened, comforting at a hospital at 4 a.m. parents whose son had just been killed by his brother driving drunk, and then helping the brother forgive himself. And I found, after 6 months, that my branch members, initially properly suspicious of an intellectual from California, had come to feel in their bones, from their direct experience, that indeed my faith and devotion to them and what mattered to them was stronger than the cords of death. And I felt that, in a sense, the results promoted in Doctrine and Covenants 122:44-46 followed. For there followed to me, without compulsory means, the power to talk about any of my concerns and passions, and to be understood and trusted, even if not agreed with. Now, this may all sound a bit selfish, even obsessive about the Church's contribution to my own spiritual maturity. But what was happening to me was happening to others. A young couple came to the branch who had lived abroad, away from the Church, for a year right after the wife had been converted and they had married. Their Church experience, especially hers, had been essentially oriented to gospel concepts and convictions, deeply felt and idealistic but abstract, involving very little service to others. She was a dignified and emotionally reserved woman, bright, creative, and judgmental, and thus afraid of uncontrolled situations or emotional exposure. He was meticulous, intimidating, somewhat aloof. I called them, despite some resistance on their part, into positions of increasing responsibility and direct involvement with people in the branch, and I saw them, at the expense of some pain and tears, to develop into powerfully open, empathetic, vulnerable people, able to understand, serve, learn from, and be trusted by people very different from themselves. I saw them learn that the very exposures, exasperations, troubles, sacrifices, and disappointments that characterize involvement in a lay church like ours, and that are especially difficult for idealistic liberals to endure, are a main source of the Church's power to teach us to love. Those two people are now teaching others what they have learned. This lesson, that the Church's characteristic problems are among its strengths, has been continuously confirmed as I have served as a bishop of a ward of young married students at Brigham Young University. The two most direct, miraculous, and ultimately redemptive blessings the Lord gave us when the ward was organized were what looked only like problems. A spastic, quadriplegic child in one family and seriously handicapped parents in another. I had known the crippled child's mother for nearly a year. As a visiting high counselor, I had spoken on the atonement at her sacrament meeting, and she had approached me afterwards for counsel and help. She was feeling deep anger and guilt as she tried to understand the failure of hospital care that made one of two twins into a desperate physical and emotional and financial burden, one which had ended her husband's education and intended profession, severely tested their marriage and their faith as priesthood blessings seemed to fail and left her close to a breakdown and apostasy. Now, a year later, as I prayed for guidance in organizing a new ward, I felt as clearly as I ever have felt those strokes of intelligence Joseph Smith described, telling me that I should, against all common sense, call her as the Relief Society president. I did, and despite being on the verge of moving away, she accepted. She became the main source of the unique spirit of honest communication and sense of genuine community our ward developed. She visited all the families and shared without reserve her feelings, struggles, successes, and needs. As did her husband. She spoke openly in our meetings about her son, his problems, and theirs, asked for help and accepted it, and all the while did her duty and endured. The ward members all learned from this couple how to be more open, vulnerable, gracious, and persistent, and how to turn each other for all kinds of help and not to judge. I first met the handicapped couple while they were wandering through the halls of our meeting house on our first Sunday. They were not looking for our ward. In fact, they lived just outside our boundaries. But I'm certain the Lord sent them. They required a major expenditure of our ward resources, time, welfare aid, patience, tolerance, as we worked to get them employed into decent housing, out of debt, and capable of caring for their bright, energetic child, and tried to help them become less obtrusive in meetings and less offensive socially. And I've learned two lessons. First, the church structure and resources, which are designed for voluntary and cooperative but disciplined effort with long-range, essentially spiritual goals, are ideally suited as a means by which to build the necessary support system for such a couple, one which may yet succeed in keeping the family together and may even bless them with more progress. Second, the blessings have come to the ward as much as to them, as we have learned to expand greatly our ideas about acceptable behavior, and especially about our own capacities to love and serve and to learn from people we would otherwise never know. One sister called me to report on her efforts to teach the woman some housekeeping and mothering skills, confessed her earlier resentments and exasperations, and told me in tears how much her heart had softened and her proud neck had bent as she had learned how to learn from this sister so different from herself. These are examples, I believe, of what Paul was talking about in 1 Corinthians 12, the great chapter on gifts, where he teaches that all the parts of the body of Christ, the church, are needed for their separate gifts, and in fact that those with less honorable and uncomely gifts are more needed and more in need of attention and honor, perhaps because the world would automatically honor and use the others. It is in the church especially that those with qualities, gifts, of vulnerability, pain, handicap, need, ignorance, intellectual arrogance, social pride, even prejudice and sin, those Paul calls the members which seem to be more feeble, can be accepted, learned from, helped, and made part of the body so that it together it can all be blessed. It is there that those with the more comely and world-honored gifts of riches and intelligence can learn what they most need to serve and love and patiently learn from those with other gifts. But that is very hard for the rich and wise to do. And that is why those who have one of those dangerous gifts tend to misunderstand and sometimes disparage the church, which, after all, is made up of the common and unclean, the middle class, middlebrow, politically unsophisticated, even prejudiced, average members like most of us. And we all know how exasperating they can be. I am convinced that in exasperation lies our salvation. If we can let the context which most brings it out, the church, also be our school for unconditional love. But that requires a change of perspective, one I will now summarize. The church is as true as, that is, as effective for salvation as, the gospel. The church is where there is fruitful opposition, the place where its own revealed nature and inspired direction maintains an opposition between liberal and conservative values, faith and doubt, secure authority and frightening freedom, individual integrity and public responsibility, and thus where there will be misery as well as holiness, bad as well as good. And if we cannot stand the misery and struggle, if we would prefer that the church be a compound in one, such as Lehi described, smooth and perfect and unchallenging, without internal opposition, and thus vanished away, rather than as it is, full of nagging human diversity and constant insistence that we perform ordinances and obey instructions and take seriously teachings embodying paradoxes that are not logically resolvable, if we refuse to lose ourselves wholeheartedly in such a school, then we will never know the redeeming truth of the church. If we constantly ask, "What has the church done for me?" we will not think to ask the much more important question, "What am I doing with the opportunities for service and self-challenge with which the church provides me?" If we constantly approach the church as consumers, we will never partake of its sweet and filling fruit. Only if we can lose our lives, there we will find ourselves. It is precisely in the struggle to be obedient while maintaining independence, to have faith while being true to reason and evidence, to serve and love in the face of imperfections, even offenses, that we can gain the humility we need to allow divine power to enter our lives in transforming ways. Perhaps the most amazing paradox about the Church is that it literally brings together the divine and the human, through priesthood service, the ordinances, the gift of the Spirit, in concrete ways that no abstract systems of ideas ever could. My purpose here has not been to ignore the very real problems of the Church or the power of the gospel truths. As I have tried to indicate all along, the Church's paradoxical strength derives from the truthful paradoxes of the gospel it embodies. Contraries we need to struggle with the more profoundly in the Church. And we must all engage, not merely in accepting the struggles and exasperations of the Church as redemptive, but in genuinely trying to reach solutions where possible and reduce unnecessary exasperations. Indeed, it is only when we grapple with the problems, not merely as intellectual exercises, but as problems in need of solution, that they prove redemptive. But along with our sensitivity to problems, we must also, I believe, have more respect for the truth of action, of experience, that the Church uniquely exposes us to, and must respond with courage and creativity. We must be active, thoughtful, faithful, believing, truth-seeking, struggling, unified members of the body of Christ. To do so, we must accept the Church as true in two very important senses. First, it is a repository of crucial, redemptive truths and of their authority to perform essential saving ordinances. Though, as I have observed, those truths can be difficult to pin down to simple propositions. Taken together, they motivate and make efficacious the willingness to serve that creates the redemptive schooling I have described. Second, besides being the repository of two principles and authority, the Church is the instrument provided by a loving God to help us become like Him, that is, to give us essential schooling, experiences with each other that can bind us together in an honest but loving community, which is the essential nurturing place for salvation. If we cannot accept the Church and the challenge it offers with the openness and courage and humility they require, then I believe our historical studies and our theological enterprises are mainly a waste of time and possibly destructive. We cannot properly appreciate the history of Mormonism or know the truth of Christ's restored gospel unless we understand and act on the truth of His Church.